But he doesn't do it. And he hasn't done it. And you find yourself getting impatient with God. You know that something needs to happen in that ministry that you're involved in? And you've been asking God to do it. You've been waiting for God to do it, but it hasn't happened. And you get impatient with God. You look at a certain relationship, and you know that God could change that relationship. You know that God could cause that relationship to happen. You know that God could do that, but he doesn't do it. And you find yourself struggling with the reality that God doesn't always work on our time schedule. Our question tonight, what do? When you get impatient with God. That, of course, was going to be a desperate temptation for the children of Israel when finally they were ready to start moving forward after their 38 years of wilderness experience and move toward the promised land and move into the promised land and begin to settle there. There would be time after time after time when God wouldn't be working on their time schedule. And the temptation that they would face is to be a little impatient with God. It's at times like that that somehow the person of God, rather, seems to sort of retreat. And you say, God, where are you? I mean, why don't you come? It's at times like that that the promises of God, that sometimes are such an encouragement and such a blessing to us, actually taunt us and tease us and irritate us. We look at the promise, we quote the promise, we read the promise from the Word of God, and instead of blessing us, and instead of encouraging us, it makes us a little angry, because God hasn't done it. And that promise, instead of being a real blessing, is a little bit of an irritant in our lives. The plan and purpose of God, that for a period of time seemed to be unfolding so wonderfully and so encouragingly, all of a sudden, seems to be aborted by God. And you look heavenward and you say, God, you seem to be leading, you seem to be directing, you seem to be calling, you seem to be putting this all together, and now it's not happening. Have you aborted the plan, God? Have you withdrawn yourself from me? Where are you, God? See, that's the emotion. That's the dynamic of those desperately, desperately serious times in our lives. When God isn't on schedule with us, and we get impatient with God, my question, how does a man of faith, how does a woman of faith respond at times like that? Well, the temptation is going to be to do exactly what Abraham and Sarah did when they got impatient with God. The story is found in Genesis chapter 16. Let's turn in our Bibles to Genesis chapter 16. And Moses is going to record this story for this young emerging generation to warn them of the consequences of inappropriately responding to impatience with God. He records it, and the Spirit of God has left it for us because he well knows that that's a problem that many of us have because of our temperament and our style of living. It's the temptation to get impatient with God. And he is going to give us some helpful and, I hope, profitable instruction from the story. The setting is established in the very first line of verse 1 of chapter 16. It says, now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. Now you need to understand, ladies and gentlemen, the pain and the frustration and the embarrassment that's wrapped up in those very few words. You see, it was exactly 10 years ago that God had come to Abraham and said, Abraham, if you get out and if you be a blessing, I've got a few promises I'm going to make to you. And one of those promises is that I'm going to wonderfully bless you. And I'm going to make a nation out of you. And out of that offspring will come not only a nation, but through that nation will come a blesser who will bring blessing to all of the families of the earth. That was God's commitment 10 years ago. And you will remember from our study last night, Abraham got out. And Abraham was a blessing. But 10 years have passed, and there's no baby. I guess perhaps it was maybe 8 years ago, when in the last phase of chapter 13, God appears to Abraham and says, Abraham, take a look at the grains of sand that cover the floor of the desert that you're walking across. Can you number those grains of sand, Abraham? Well, Abraham responds just the way most of us would respond. God, you got to be kidding. Of course I can. Abraham, you're going to have a seed that is going to outnumber the grains of sand on the desert floor. But friends, 8 years have passed, and there's still no baby. Perhaps it was 3 or 4 years ago. It's in one of those beautiful, brightly starlit nights in the east when God interrupts Abraham, invites him to step out of his tent and take a look up. And as the last few verses of Genesis chapter 15 say, God invites Abraham to start counting again. And Abraham's response is, Lord, that's impossible. Can't count the stars. Abraham, here's my promise. You're going to have an offspring that's going to outnumber all of the stars in the heavens. But you see, 4 years have passed, ladies and gentlemen, and there's still no baby. And the fact of the matter is, the conditions have been significantly complicated by the fact that now Abraham is 85 years of age, Sarah is 75 years of age, and the Bible tells us that she is now beyond the age of childbearing. She is barren. What do you do when you take a promise from God that hasn't been fulfilled? What do you do when it hasn't happened? I can imagine, some of you can imagine, that night after night, Abraham and Sarah have gone to bed and they prayed. They said, Lord, tonight, give us that baby. Lord, fulfill that promise. Lord, keep your word. Lord, give us that baby. But for 10 years, there has been no fulfillment of that promise. And now they look at the human possibility and say, it's impossible. It seems as though all of a sudden God, who was very much part of their life, is 100 million miles away. It seems as though that promise that had blessed their hearts and thrilled them as a mom and dad, or as a husband and wife rather, without a baby, without a family, that had thrilled them, that promise that had just blessed their hearts. You can imagine how they would have talked about it. That promise now isn't a blessing. That promise is an irritant. It's a frustration. It hasn't happened. It could have happened. God could have done this. But God hasn't done it. God, where are you? The plan, it all started to fall in place 10 years ago, and man, it was working out wonderfully. Now it looks as though God's aborted. He's just jettisoned the plan. You see, that's the problem that Abraham and Sarah face in Genesis chapter 16. I submit to you that it's a problem that every Christian leader faces over and over again. It's a problem that parents face in raising children. It's a problem that businessmen encounter trying to cope with their business. God isn't on schedule with us. He isn't in tune with our agenda. And he hasn't answered our prayer. He hasn't kept his promise. Humanly speaking, it looks as though it's not going to happen. What do you do? What do you do? Well, the temptation is to take matters into our hands and to make it happen. And Americans and Canadians are really good at that. That's what Abraham and Sarah do in Genesis chapter 16. Let me read the next couple of verses that show their response. It says, and she, that is Hagar, Sarah, had an Egyptian maid whose name was Hagar. So Sarah said to Abram, now behold, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Please go into my maid, perhaps I shall obtain children through her. And Abram listened to the voice of Sarah. And after Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Abram's wife Sarai took Hagar, the Egyptian, her maid, and gave her to her husband Abram as his wife. And he went into Hagar, and she conceived. Don't jump on Abraham and Sarah too quickly. Don't be too smart in throwing your charges and accusations at them. Be very careful. You see, the first thing that you need to understand about what they did was that in the days of the ancient Near East, it was very socially acceptable. This was the way that kind of problem was handled in the days of the ancient Near East. It was very important for a couple to have children, to have offspring. And that was the way that property, real estate, that's the way property was handed down. And so if a couple did not have babies, for whatever reason, arrangements were made like this, whereby the father could ultimately decide whether he would adopt the offspring of such a relationship to become his adopted son and his heir to his real estate, to his kingdom. That's precisely what Joseph decides to do when he discovers that Mary is pregnant. He makes a decision that he is going to adopt the offspring of Mary and make that child his legal child. Well, that's what happens with Abraham and Sarah. You see, what they do is very socially acceptable. While you raise your eyebrows, you need to understand nobody in the neighborhood would have done that in Genesis 16. No one would have pointed their finger at them. No one would have said, how could you? That was the way it was done. It was just handled that way in their culture and society. Now, mind you, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying it's right. What I'm saying to you, however, is that's the way everybody handled it. The second thing you need to know about what they did was that it was unbelievably unselfish. Every lady, every married lady, every lady in the audience this evening feels her stomach turn just a little bit at a story like this. And you're inclined to turn to Sarah and say, Sarah, how could you do this? It was an extremely unselfish thing that Sarah did. Why does she do it? Well, the third thing that you need to understand is that it was a very well-motivated, very highly motivated thing. I suspect that if you were to touch Sarah on the shoulder and ask her why she suggested such a scheme, she would say, it's something like, well, our commitment is to see the promise that God has made fulfilled. Abraham, how come you're going along with this? Well, it's because God has promised a nation through which is going to come a blesser. We need to have a baby, and it's not humanly possible for us to do it. So I'm doing it to fulfill the will of God. I'm doing it to bring to pass God's plan and purpose. I'm doing it to demonstrate that God is true to his word and God keeps his word. I don't know what words they would have used, but do you understand what I'm saying? You see, this isn't a sordid story of sex. We're not talking about an orgy. What we're talking about is two godly people, a little impatient with God, and taking matters into their own hands and using a method that was part of their culture and society to solve a little problem, and to solve it in such a way that God's plans would go ahead, God's purposes would be advanced, God's name would be held credible. That's the motivation that's behind it. And that's why I say we need to be just a little careful about being too critical of Abraham and Sarah. The fact of the matter is, most of us have done precisely the same thing 100 times over. When we've got impatient with God, we've taken matters into our own hands, and we've handled the situation the way our culture handles the situation. Our motivation may be honorable, and there may be considerable sacrifice involved in what we've done. We've done exactly what they've done 100 times over. The problem with their action and the problem with our action is that the fourth thing that you could say about what they did was that it was one step ahead of God. That was the problem. It was a step ahead of God. Now, when men and women get impatient with God, that's the temptation. It's to take a step ahead of God and take matters into our own hands in order to make it happen. There are three characteristics of what we will call a step ahead of God. Churches take it sometimes in connection with building plans. Young people take it sometimes in connection with entering into a marriage. Business persons take it sometimes in moving toward an investment. They take a step ahead of God. And there are always three distinctive characteristics of such a step. Step number one involved in that step ahead of God, the first element involved in it, is that it's taken in our time, not God's time. Now, let me just remind you, Abraham and Sarah are going to have a baby, right? Come on now, right? They are going to have a baby. But they're not going to have it till Genesis chapter 21. Not in Genesis chapter 16. And so what Abraham and Sarah do is they get ahead of God. God's not marching to their schedule, and so they move ahead of God. One of the things that is very difficult to avoid for even a casual reader of the Bible is that God is always on his schedule. As a matter of fact, let's take just a few moments and see if we can demonstrate that to each other. What I want you to do is to give me an illustration from the Bible. Give me a story from the Bible. Give me an incident from the Bible that illustrates to you that God is always right on schedule. Talk to me. All right. Mary and Martha and Lazarus and the Lord's delaying 4 days. Give me another story. Man, a minute or two late, the whole story of Jonah would be very different, wouldn't it? That great fish right there, right at exactly the moment when Jonah hits the waves. Give me another story. Over here? The birth of Christ, when the fullness of the time was come. Sir Robert Anderson does the dating from Daniel chapter 9 and says that it's on exactly the day that God had predicted back there. The birth of Christ, the death of Christ, was right on schedule over here. Joseph in prison, again, a marvelous demonstration of God being on schedule. Give me some more. Philip and the eunuch. Philip's going this way through the desert, the eunuch's going this way through the desert, and lo and behold, they meet in the middle of the desert. You see, you can go through the scriptures, and over again, ladies and gentlemen, we have abundant evidence to demonstrate that God is on his schedule. He's not always on ours. That's when we get ticked off with God. That's when we get really impatient and sometimes downright angry with God. He's not on our schedule, but it's important for us to remember he's always on his schedule. He's got a plan, and his plan is scheduled according to his agenda. When we get impatient with God, the temptation is to take a step ahead of God. And when we take a step ahead of God, it's on our time schedule, not God's time schedule. The second characteristic of such a step is that it's our method, not God's method, that is involved. You see, God's got a method by which this baby that Abraham and Sarah are going to have will take place. The method is going to be, here's the word, supernatural. It's going to be miraculous. That's how the baby's going to come. The method they settle for is natural. They make a baby, all right? They make a baby. They do it naturally. God was going to make a baby. And the baby that he was going to make was going to be made supernaturally. They settled for a natural solution to the problem. And moved ahead of God's timing. Rather than waiting for God's timing to experience a supernatural solution. Got it? Now, the third characteristic of a step taken ahead of God is that it's a step that's taken in our energy and our strength instead of in God's strength. This is where Americans and Canadians excel. As a matter of fact, most of the things that we do in our churches Sunday after Sunday, we could do quite well without God. We cause them to happen. We make them happen. We plan it, we schedule it, we've got all of our skills, we've got all of our training. We would hardly know if God withdrew the Holy Spirit and took him back to heaven for a Sunday. We've got the machinery in place. We can make things happen. We're in the Western culture of the 20th century. That's the great danger of getting impatient with God. We settle for a natural solution to a supernatural problem, and we make it happen in our energy. Of course, in the process, we end up with heart attacks and with ulcers and with high blood pressure and stress and 100 other kinds of things that fracture our relationships with each other, that destroy our marriages and families, and fracture our relationship with God. That's a step ahead of God. Now, I simply want to propose to you that rather than us throwing the darts and attacking Abraham and Sarah, that we take this and apply it to ourselves for a moment. You see, what Moses knows is that when the children of Israel start moving toward the land of Canaan, and when they start going in to take the land of Canaan, there is going to be times when they're going to get impatient with God. God's not going to move on their schedule. And they're going to have some dynamic leadership that's ready to go. And the temptation that they're going to face over and over again is the temptation to take a step ahead of God. Do it on their timetable, not his. Do it their way, not his. Do it in their strength, not his. And that's the problem that I struggle with over and over again in my life. It's a problem that my colleagues in Christian ministry and Christian leadership struggle with over and over again. It's a problem that every parent struggles with in raising their children. It's a struggle that every Christian involved in any aspect of the business world struggles with. It's the struggle of what to do when God isn't on our schedule. And how to handle that prayer that's not being answered. That thing that needs to be done and God can do it in an instant, but he isn't doing it. Moses knows, and God the Spirit knows, that the temptation is going to be to take matters into our hands, to move ahead of God. I could take you around the countryside and point out to you certain church buildings that obviously were built a step ahead of God. I could point to you to many, many more friends than I care to admit who got a little impatient with God about marriage and moved one step ahead of God into a marriage. I don't know quite so many, but I do know a few business people who have got a little impatient with God in their business endeavors, in their business investments. They've got a little impatient with God. They take matters into their own hands. And they've made things happen. They've taken a step ahead of God. I know parents who have the very best of intentions in raising their children, who get a little impatient with God. God isn't doing it. And so they say, then I'll do it. And they get impatient with God. Move ahead of God. They say, if God's not going to do it, then I'll do it. We know how to do it. And so they move on their time schedule. They move in their energy. They move in their methodology. It's the way everybody else is doing it. We just buy into the culture. Nobody raises their eyebrows. Nobody points the finger at us. Everybody handles a business problem. Everybody handles a problem teenager. Everybody handles a relationship like that. That's the way it's handled in our culture. And so we buy into it, and we move ahead, and we do it. Now, why do you think Moses records this story? He doesn't record it in order to embarrass us so that we'll be a little reluctant to read this story and talk about it at a Sunday morning service. Frankly, I'd be a little embarrassed, I suppose, to talk the way I'm talking tonight at a Sunday morning service. But he didn't read it to embarrass us and to cause us to back away from the story and say, oh, how terrible. What he did was he recorded it to teach us how faith responds when we get impatient with God. And the tragic consequences of not responding that way. Because Abraham and Sarah didn't respond that way, and the rest of the chapter tells us the consequences. Beginning again in the middle of verse 4, we read, and when she saw, Sarah, that she had conceived, or Hagar rather, when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress, that is Sarah, was despised in her sight. Now, I don't understand a lot about the relationship between Hagar and Sarah. I suspect that they were bosom buddies. Just from the makeup of the story, I don't imagine Sarah giving her husband over into the arms and into the bed of a tramp on the street. That's not what happened. What Sarah does is point out her most trusted friend, her most loyal companion. She has Hagar. And so she trusts her husband to Hagar. She gives him over into the arms of her best friend, her bosom companion. When Hagar conceives, she begins to feel just a little arrogant and a little superior. And she despises Sarah. Consequence number one, a wedge is driven between Hagar and Sarah, and the relationship is fractured. The text continues. It says in verse 5, and Sarah said to Abraham, may the wrong done me be upon you. I gave my maid into your arms, and when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her sight. May the Lord judge between you and me. That last line of verse 5 is the vernacular of the days of the ancient Near East, the saying, Abraham, this is all your fault. Sort of sounds like a woman, doesn't it? Well, one of my good women friends in the audience has given me a very bad look, so I need to adjust it. Sort of sounds like human nature, doesn't it? That's what it is. It's human nature. Abraham and Sarah, who as far as we know were getting along just fine, all of a sudden have a wedge driven between them. Do you see the pattern that's developed? The relationship between Hagar and Sarah is fractured and broken. The relationship between Abraham and Sarah is fractured and broken. Those are the immediate consequences of this impulsive action on the part of Abraham and Sarah. But that's only the beginning. It says in verse 6, but Abram said to Sarah, behold, your maid is in your power. Do to her what is good in your sight. So Sarah treated her harshly. She fled from her presence. Now the angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, by the spring on the way to Shur. He said, Hagar, Sarah's maid, where have you come from and where are you going? She said, I am fleeing from the presence of my mistress, Sarah. Then the angel of the Lord said to her, return to your mistress, submit yourself to her authority. Moreover, the angel of the Lord said to her, I will greatly multiply your descendants so that they shall be too many to count. Does that have a ring? Have you ever heard that before? I'm going to greatly multiply your descendants, Hagar, so that they be too many to count, more than the stars in the heaven, more than the sands of the seashore. The same kind of promise is given to Hagar about the baby that she's carrying. Verse 11 continues. The angel of the Lord said to her further, behold, you are with child, and you shall bear a son, and you shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has given heed to your affliction. Ishmael means, in the Hebrew, God hears. What an interesting name. Every time Hagar is going to call her son for years to come, it's going to remind her that when she was desolate and abandoned and out in the wilderness and weeping and crying and praying under that tree, God hears. What a wonderful encouragement that name must have been to Hagar for years to come. That same name must have been a sharp, piercing sword to Abraham. Every morning he steps outside the tent and says, Ishmael, Ishmael, breakfast! Ishmael, slaughter time! Every time he calls that name, God hears, God hears. See, there came a time when Abraham thought God didn't hear. God hadn't heard. And he chose to take matters into his own hands and make it happen. That name must have been a reminder to him for years to come of his impatience, his impulsiveness, his moving ahead from God. Well, verse 12 gives us a little description of this baby that's going to be born. Verse 12 says, and he will be a wild donkey of a man. I've often thought that would not be a complimentary thing to say to an expectant mother. Let me tell you about the son that you're going to have. He's going to be a wild donkey of a man. Well, it's not talking about character. It's talking about lifestyle. Wild donkeys roamed the desert. And I suspect that what he's saying is that your offspring will be like the nomads. They're going to roam the deserts the way wild donkeys do. The next line says, his hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him. Leupold, a very appreciated and fine scholar in the Old Testament, says, it means he will have a chip on his shoulder and his finger on the trigger. That's the kind of offspring she's going to have. And then the last line is a very problematic line in terms of the translation. He will live to the east of all his brothers. And grammarians tell us that what that line implies is conflict between him and his brothers, and the conflict will relate to the land in which they're living. I simply need to tell you that Ishmael one day was born. Ishmael grew up, and Ishmael had 12 sons and one daughter. Does that remind you of anyone else? One day Jacob is born, and Jacob has 12 sons and one daughter. Ishmael has 12 sons and one daughter. From Jacob comes the 12 tribes of Israel. From Ishmael come the 12 Arab nations of the world. And ladies and gentlemen, for 4,000 years, there has been perpetual hostility between the descendants of Ishmael and the descendants of Jacob. And that hostility has related to the land in which they've lived. For 4,000 years, the Middle East has borne the consequences of one act of impatience with God, moving ahead of God, moving on God's schedule, and doing it our way, in our energy, and in our time, rather than God's time, in God's way, and in God's energy. What's the lesson? Hard to avoid. Impatience with God leaves a heritage. It leaves a train of hostility. That's the message he wants them to understand. Every time you go to the gas pump and pay that atrocious price for gasoline, you're paying for what Abraham did in Genesis 16. Next time you listen to what's going on in the Middle East, You just remember Genesis chapter 16. It's a constant reminder to God's people of every age that when you get impatient with God, take matters into your hands, and move into a relationship, move into a ministry, handle the situation the way everybody else is handling it, but do it in your time and in your energy and in your strength, you're inviting a perpetual heritage of hostility and trouble and conflict. That's the message of the passage. Of course, the counterside, the other side of the coin is what faith does when it gets impatient with God is wait and wait and wait patiently for the Lord. See, Moses knows that the children of Israel very, very much needed to understand this lesson. They were going to come to the land of Canaan, and they were going to be tested upon their ability to trust God and to wait upon God. You remember when they came to the Jordan River? I suppose that there were a bunch of those leaders who said, hey, listen, it's time for a surprise attack. Let's do it tonight. No, says God. I want you to spend 2 or 3 days on the side of the Jordan. You need to get yourselves right with God. You've got to be kidding, Joshua. That's crazy. We don't want to let them know that we're here. Let's go for it. Let's do it. Let's make them a surprise attack. That's the way every army handles these kinds of situations. No, Joshua says, God says, we're going to wait. We're going to wait 3 days. We're going to get things right. Time to enter the Jordan River. Boy, let's do it all together and move forward. No, we're going to just do it patiently. We're going to do it according to God's order. And we're going to let the priest's feet step in first. And then the real test was when they come to the Jericho walls. 7 days? Walk around those walls? Give them 7 days to get their armories together and their weapons together and to get all ready for the attack? Joshua, you've got to be nuts. It's a surprise attack. That's the way every army handles these kinds of situations. It's a surprise attack. If we're going to take Jericho, we're not going to give them 7 days warning and let them get ready for it. Now Joshua says, we're going to do it in God's time. We're going to do it God's way. And it's going to be in God's strength that we take the walls of Jericho. See, that's the lesson of the story. There are going to be times in Israel's history when they're not going to learn that lesson. They looked at all the nations around them and they were prospering militarily. They were prospering economically. They were prospering socially. They were prospering politically because they had a king. And Israel didn't have a king. And so the leaders come to Samuel and they say, Samuel, give us a king. And Samuel says, it's not time yet. It was obviously God's plan for them to have a king. He made that very clear when Jacob was on his deathbed and he turned to Judah and he said, Judah, the scepter is not going to depart from your tribe. The king is going to come from your tribe. It's obviously God's plan for them to have a king. And God's man was David. But they got impatient with God. And they handled it the way everybody else handled it. If all the other nations have got a king, nobody's going to point their finger at us. Nobody's going to say that's wrong. That's the way all of these nations are handling it and prospering. If we're going to keep up with them, we got to have a king, Samuel. And so Samuel goes to God, and God says, all right, I'll give them a king. It's on their time schedule, not mine. But you tell them that that king will take their wives, he will take their sons, he will take their daughters, he will take their lands. It's one of the tragic, tragic passages of the Old Testament. It'll be nothing but tragedy. See, that's the lesson of Genesis chapter 16. Men and women, when we get impatient with God, are tempted to move ahead of God and invite disaster and trouble and all kinds of problems. What faith does is it waits for God's time, God's way, God's energy. Now let me just compare what I've done tonight with what I did last night. Really contrast, rather. Last night, the message was that the real ultimate challenge of faith for some men and women is to jump out of a window blindfolded. Is to take the step off the edge of a cliff. The message from Genesis chapter 12 is go for it. Go for it. Go on. Go for it. God has said he'll give it to you. I dare you. There's the challenge. Go for it. That was the message last night. Now tonight the message is exactly the opposite. The message tonight is, wait. Don't jump. Don't leap. Don't take one step ahead of God's timing. Wait. Faith sometimes is ultimately tested by the challenge to go for it and risk and do something that looks really ridiculous. Faith sometimes is ultimately challenged by the willingness to wait. Just to wait. Now you ask me how you know which to do, and I'll have to shake my head and say, I have no idea. I don't know. That's something between you and God. My guess, however, is that most of us won't have a difficult time sorting it out. And that's because these two scenarios that I painted to you directly relate to two kinds of people. In Psalm 32, it says, be not like the horse or the mule. You know the difference between a horse and a mule? They both need a bridle, but they need it for different reasons. The horse needs a bridle to hold it back, because its natural tendency is to push ahead. The mule needs a bridle to pull it ahead, because its natural tendency is to hold back. Our congregation this evening is divided into horses and mules. Some of you are very impulsive. You're very impetuous. Man, you like to jump out of windows. Stepping off the edges of cliffs are just the kind of thing that life is made of for you. That's no challenge to your faith. You love to do that. Some of you, I like the mules. You're a little cautious, a little careful. Modern psychology divides our popular human race into three categories. Some of us are type A personality, some of us are type Bs, and some of us are type Cs. Apparently 50% of us are type As. Those are the drivers. Those are the chargers. About 40% of us are type Bs. They're the cautious people. They're the people who hold back. And about 10% of us are a mixture. Now, listen to me carefully. The message last night primarily was for mules and for type Bs, where the ultimate challenge and test of faith is to be prepared to risk something, to step off, to jump, to go for it. I know it's ridiculous, but God says go for it. That's the ultimate challenge of faith for that kind of person. The message tonight is for you type A's. It's for you horses. Your tendency is to move ahead of God and to use all of your skills and all of your training and all of your education and to make it happen. Your danger is when you get a little impatient with God because he's not marching to your tune. He's not on schedule with you. Your tendency is to move ahead. And the great challenge of a life of faith to you is to be ready to wait. And to wait. And to wait. So that it will be done in God's time, God's energy, and in God's way. For many of us, the most difficult thing in the world is to wait. And if you're a type A personality, if you're one of those horses, then you know exactly what I mean. It's one of the most difficult things for us to do, just to wait. Andrew Murray says, be assured that if God waits longer than you could wish, it is only to make the blessing doubly precious. God waited 4,000 years till the fullness of the time was come before he sent his son. Our times are in his hands. He will avenge his elect speedily. He will make haste for our help and not delay 1 hour too long. My experience in life as a type A personality, as a horse, is the most difficult thing to do. The greatest test of faith is to be ready to wait for God's time and for God's energy and for God's way. I've struggled with it in raising my children. The thing that I've struggled with all my life in raising my children is to take matters into my hands and make it happen and to do it. I struggle with my ministry. I can mobilize people. I can motivate people. I can make some things happen. And the great temptation and the great challenge to my step of faith, it takes more faith for me to wait than it takes for me to go. You understand? That's the message tonight. And God has showed me that from some of the disasters that have followed, and some of the pain and some of the hurt that's come, God has showed me that the great test of faith on my part is being willing to wait patiently for God. So I want to say to you tonight who are the racehorses, to you who are the drivers, to you who are the people who can really make things happen, the real test of your faith is to wait patiently for God. And if you learn to do that, then He's going to open for you the blessings that come when things are done on His schedule and in His energy and in His way. And as a result, greater glory will come to Him and greater blessing will come to you. Lord, teach us that, we pray.